This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the death of the longest-serving justice on the U.S. Supreme Court triggers drama and controversy for President Barack Obama in his final year in office. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The sudden death in February of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia in the middle of a presidential election campaign has ignited a firestorm over whether or not President Obama should nominate his successor or if such a consequential decision should be taken by the next president. A great deal is at stake regarding the dynamics of the court. With Justice Scalia, the conservatives on the court enjoy a slim 5-4 majority, even though Justice Anthony Kennedy occasionally votes with his more liberal colleagues. Soon after Scalia's passing, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, voiced opposition to President Obama nominating a successor. The Republican presidential contenders also called for Scalia's replacement to be named by the next president. McConnell said that, quote, the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Therefore, his vacancy should not be filled until we have a new president, unquote. Meantime, President Obama says it's his constitutional responsibility to nominate a replacement, and he expects the Senate to give the nominee a timely hearing and a vote. The top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, concurs with President Obama, saying that the Senate has the constitutional duty to, quote, advise and consent. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the front-runner in the Democratic presidential primary, said those calling for Justice Scalia's seat to remain vacant until the next president is elected dishonor our Constitution. And she echoed President Obama by saying that, quote, the U.S. Senate has a constitutional responsibility that it cannot abdicate for partisan political reasons, unquote. Meantime, according to the Washington Post newspaper, the White House is said to be considering several new federal judges for President Obama's nomination, focusing on jurists with barely discernible ideology and limited judicial records as part of a strategy to overcome strong Republican opposition. Well, with us to discuss the legacy of Antonin Scalia and the controversy surrounding who should replace him and when are two distinguished constitutional experts. John Malcolm is director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative policy group based here in Washington. And Alan Morrison, he's associate dean for public interest and public service at the George Washington University School of Law, where he also teaches constitutional law. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Carol.
Well, John Malcolm over at the Heritage Foundation, let me begin with you. Just briefly, before we get into the controversies, could you summarize for us the judicial legacy and philosophy of Antonin Scalia? He's the longest-serving justice on the court appointed by President Reagan. He was known as a originalist and a textualist, so to speak. How do you define his legacy?
Justice Scalia was a legal giant whose influence will be felt in law schools and among lawyers and by judges for decades to come, and his opinions are going to be read in law schools for decades to come. He was an originalist, meaning that when it came to constitutional issues, he believed in the court paying attention to the text and interpreting the text of the Constitution according to its original public meaning, as was understood by the people at the time that the Constitution was ratified, or at the time that the amendments were ratified. With respect to statutes, he was also a textualist in that he believed that one had to pay attention to the text of the statutes and not try to follow, say, legislative history or to divine some purpose or try to figure out what consequences might flow from alternative readings, but to focus on the most logical, clearest meaning of the law as passed by both houses of the legislature and actually signed into law by the president.
Turning to you, Alan Morrison, how would you characterize Justice Scalia's legacy?
Well, let me say the first thing about it is, for those of us who have argued before the Supreme Court, having Justice Scalia not be there will change the dynamics of oral argument greatly. He was a ferocious questioner, and everybody who argued there knew you had to be prepared for him. And when he got onto you, he didn't let go. And there's nobody who asks questions quite like that, in part because he's been there for quite some time and he has a very strong personality. So that will clearly be a big difference in terms of the oral argument. Second, he turns by far the pithiest phrases of any justice. John said that his opinions will be read. They surely will be read because they're interesting and exciting, and he has great ways of putting things. On the other hand, he had some pretty off-putting things in some of his opinions about some of the other justices. And just last year, I think the world came to an end on 6 or 7 different occasions when he was in dissent, and I wrote a piece called Crying Wolf talking about it. Couldn't all be that terrible. So he clearly saw things in blacks and whites. I agree with John also that whether one agrees with him or not, he certainly has pushed the court, and I think everybody in the court, more toward a textual reading. For example, Justice Breyer, who is probably the person most vocal in terms of writing off the court about this, often talks about other things that matter to him, the purpose of the law, what the statute was trying to do, what the Constitution was trying to do. He also looks at the consequences of the law. Does this make sense? Is this what people thought they were doing when they passed this law? I remember an opinion of Justice Scalia in which he said it was an employment discrimination case in which he came down on the side of the employee. And he said both sides are arguing there'll be terrible consequences no matter what happens. He said, we don't have to pay any attention to the consequences because the statute is clear. So he's clearly influenced the court on that. And finally, on the legislative history point, Justice Scalia was very firm. He didn't think any form of legislative history was useful, including the conference reports, the hearings, amendments that were introduced. He wouldn't pay any attention to that. He has had a very significant influence, and he will continue to have a significant influence.
We'll come back to the court, its composition at the end of the program, but turning to you now again, John Malcolm, about what faces President Obama at this point. Now, of course, nominating a Supreme Court justice is one of the most consequential decisions of a president. It's a lifetime appointment. The court is currently split. There's a lot at stake. Why, in your view, is there a chorus, particularly from the Republican-controlled Congress and presidential candidates, against President Obama naming a replacement for Scalia when the Constitution says this is his duty to do so?
Well, let's parse that out. So there's nothing that the Republicans are going to be able to say to prevent President Obama from nominating somebody to the Supreme Court, and the Constitution clearly gives him the right to nominate somebody for the Supreme Court. Article 2, Section 2 clearly provides that the president gets to nominate and appoint judges to the Supreme Court of the United States, but only with the advice and consent of the Senate. So President Obama will be acting well within his rights to nominate somebody for the Supreme Court, and the Senate will be well within its rights to either give its advice and consent or withhold its advice and consent. There is nothing in the Constitution that mandates that a nominee get an up or down vote, and there's nothing in the Constitution that mandates that the Senate even hold a hearing. In fact, over our nation's history, the names of 160 men and women have been sent to the Senate for consideration to be justices on the Supreme Court. 36 of those were denied. They were not confirmed to the Supreme Court, and 25 of those nominees, in fact, never ended up getting a hearing. As you just noted, Justice Scalia was on the court for 30 years. He was appointed by President Reagan. President Reagan left office quite some time ago. Justice Kennedy is still on the court, another Reagan appointee. So whoever the next Supreme Court justice is going to be is likely to influence the court for decades to come, long after President Obama has left office. This is a particularly pivotal time in terms of the Supreme Court's history. So there are very, very few cases that get decided 5-4, but those that do get decided 5-4 are frequently on very, very contentious issues. So over the last 3 or 4 years, the Supreme Court has decided issues by 5-4 votes on areas dealing with racial preferences, religious liberty, free speech, the Second Amendment, the death penalty, voting rights, also abortion and same-sex marriage. On many of those issues, not all of them, Justice Scalia was in the majority, and the conservative position prevailed. This next nominee could well swing the court in the other direction. We are in the middle of an election year, and the Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee and Leader McConnell have said, look, you can submit a nominee if you want to, but the people are voting here. They deserve to have a say as to who should be sitting in the Oval Office and making this next nomination that will have such great consequences to our liberties for decades to come.
Well, turning to you, Alan Morrison, for your take on why you think the Republican-controlled Congress, including, of course, congressional leadership, Charles Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, categorically have said there will be no confirmation hearings and no vote if President Obama does put forth a nominee, saying that such a monumental decision, falling in the final year of Obama's term, should be postponed for the next president.
Well, I know why they're doing it. They're doing it for political reasons. They hope to get an advantage. I agree with virtually everything that John said. I don't think there's any constitutional obligation to advise and consent. My own view is that the Republicans were unnecessarily antagonistic in saying they wouldn't hold a hearing without knowing who the nominee was or anything about him or her. And it seems to me that it makes them look like they're know-nothings. We don't care who you send up, we aren't going to confirm it. Second, they might have found some tactical advantage in being able to examine the nominee and find out some things and pin it on the Democrats. That's their problem, not mine. The last thing I want to say about it is, this is surely not going to be something that's going to go to the court in any respect. Nobody thinks anybody can sue the Senate for not holding hearings. So I assume that they will continue no matter who the president nominates, and I expect him to nominate somebody. He certainly has to do it now, given the way the politics have played out, that the Republicans will just not hold hearings, and the political consequences will flow from that. People will think they're right or wrong, and they'll take it into account. The one interesting thing I want to observe, though, is since the Republicans have said, put so much on the election, one wonders when the next president, suppose it's Hillary Clinton, comes forward, whether they will say, oh, now that the electorate has spoken, we're going to give her a lot of deference. I think that they will not. And I don't expect that they're going to say, well, now that the electorate has spoken, we're going to bend over backwards and give them more deference. I think they will take their advice and consent seriously, which kind of undercuts the notion that they should wait for the election to occur. But this is politics, and everybody understands why it's being done. And people in the country at large will make judgments about whether this is a fair way to run the government.
Can I push back on that just slightly? I don't disagree with much of what Alan just said. I suppose that the Republicans wanted to say at the outset, look, it doesn't really matter who you nominate. This is not about an individual. It's about a position and sort of who ought to be naming this next justice is going to be around for so long. As Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, said the one person I trust the most is me, and if the president were to nominate me, I wouldn't vote for me. That's at least a principled position.
Well,
I agree with Alan that it's entirely possible that this could end up backfiring. I would say this, though, that the people whose names tend to be submitted for nomination to the Senate are very, very smart people. They have certainly mastered the art of how to survive hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so whether it's a Republican nominee or a democratically named justice, they frequently will go in to those hearings and come out smelling like roses, and they will sound like moderates. And then when they get actually appointed and they take their oaths and they get up there and they're voting, they often won't vote like moderates, either on the left or on the right.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are John Malcolm, director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, from whom you just heard, and Alan Morrison. He's Associate Dean for Public Interest and Public Service at the George Washington University School of Law. And we're discussing the politics and substance surrounding the replacement of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Sunny Abdullahi Salisu in Katsina State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, let me turn back to you quickly, John Malcolm, because both of you have pretty much brought up a line of questioning that I was going to pursue, and that is, could the decision of the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and Republicans in Congress, could that change depending on President Obama's nominees? We're hearing now that he is, in fact, selecting individuals, very qualified federal judges, who have been confirmed already with bipartisan support, who are considered either moderate or non-ideological. Could that make a difference in their decision right now to basically not hold hearings?
I sincerely doubt it. I mean, you have all of the Republicans, every one of them, on the Senate Judiciary Committee who have said, it doesn't matter who you nominate, we're not going to have a hearing. And Senator McConnell has agreed with that, and they have so informed the president. We are now in a presidential race. The Supreme Court has been thrust, I'm sure much to Chief Justice Roberts' chagrin, into the center of that presidential race. And looking at it purely from a political standpoint, while the Republican senators may and probably will take it on the chin to some extent if they were to back down from that position. I assume that the Republican base would find that hugely demoralizing, and whatever pain they would suffer on the front end, they would suffer more on the back end if they change that position. But that's, of course, a political calculation.
Well, in turning to you, Alan Morrison, let's put the shoe on the other foot. What if a liberal justice died and it was a Republican president about to name a justice? Would the reaction by Republicans be different? Would Democrats, if they were in the congressional majority, try to block the nomination of a justice?
I think the answer is yes. And for better or worse, and I think for worse, the process has become so politicized that everybody looks at the appointment of a Supreme Court justice as a political opportunity to press the advantage. And so I would expect that the same thing would happen. And, you know, we've seen quotes from several members of the Senate, Vice President Biden, who said essentially this, and I just don't think there's any chance that anybody would take the opposite position. I think that's unfortunate. And the question that arises is, all right, Justice Scalia died in February. Suppose he died in December. Would they have taken the same position? How about November and back and forth? It seems to me that that's a bad line to draw, and that I think our country would be better off if we had nominations that came in when there was a vacancy and we took them on the merits. There's one other thing which I don't think people have thought so much about, and that is if President, for example, Clinton were to get the nomination, she would be in a position to name a much younger person to the court who might be there a lot longer. The Republicans could have been in a position to say, well, somebody like Merrick Garland, who sits on the D.C. Circuit, is 63 years old, a very well-respected judge. It's a lot different nominating somebody who's 63 than it is. Justice Thomas, for example, was nominated when he was 44 years old. And so that kind of dynamic has been eliminated when the Republicans have said, no, we won't listen to anybody.
So essentially, John Malcolm, the Republicans are taking a bit of a gamble here, assuming that potentially a Republican would be elected, hoping that that might be the case and that he would be the one to nominate the justice to replace Scalia. Because otherwise, if, as Alan Morrison said, whether it's Clinton or whomever, they're sure to nominate someone, you know, much more aligned with perhaps a more liberal philosophy.
This is certainly high-stakes poker. And if we have a President Clinton or President Sanders in a democratically controlled Senate, then the Republican Senate may rue the day that they took this position. On the other hand, if it's a President Cruz or Kasich or even Trump, and the Senate is still in the control of Republicans, they will be very happy that they took this position. I don't think, by the way, that you need to speculate how Senate Democrats would act if the shoe were on the other foot, because, in fact, when President Bush 41 and 43, were in office, Vice President Biden, Senator Reid, Senator Schumer, Senator Clinton, then Senator Obama made it very, very clear that they would not consider somebody who was nominated during the last year of in an election year. And indeed, President Obama and was one of the people trying to lead a filibuster against Samuel Alito. In other words, to try to deny him a vote. So yes, the court is highly politicized. I think it is a shame. Justice Scalia certainly was one of the people who decried the politicization of the court, but we are where we are.
Indeed. How is the court functioning minus Scalia, both on the mechanics and substance, John Malcolm? We note now that Justice Clarence Thomas, who hadn't asked a question in the last 10 years, started asking questions. Now liberal justices seem to be even more outspoken than ever. Can eight justices do the job and not adversely affect decisions? What if there's a split on a case until such time as we have a new justice?
Yes, no, they certainly can. I mean, the court has operated for many periods of its history with an evenly divided number. First of all, there are only maybe 25% or 30% of the cases are decided by a 5-4 vote. No, most of the cases, not the majority, but say 40% of them are unanimous. So this is only going to come up so many times. The court can always decide to hold a case over for re-argument when there is a new justice on the Supreme Court, or the court can simply affirm the lower court by an evenly divided number, and that basically has the effect as if the court had never taken the case in the first place. It doesn't have any precedential value. If there was a circuit split down below, that circuit split would remain, and the court could always take up that issue again in a future case. So look, you know, when Justice Robert Jackson was named to be chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trial, the court operated with only eight justices for over 17 months. And there have been other periods of time where there have been similarly divided court. And you know, the consequences of naming the next justice are far more important than whether or not they're going to have trouble in a particular case during that interim time period.
Turning to you, Alan Morrison, for your take on the impact of just eight justices on the Supreme Court on decisions, especially controversial ones, what is that impact?
Well, I think there are several. First, in terms of re-argument, it looks as though there will be no new justice until there's a new president. The new president is almost certain not to spend the first weeks of his or her term in office nominating a Supreme Court justice. Much more important will be get the cabinet officers in place. And in terms of simply the Judiciary Committee alone, the president needs an attorney general, solicitor general, and many other people in the Department of Justice. And as soon as the president nominates somebody for the Supreme Court, all the rest of the nominees in the Judiciary Committee would certainly fall by the wayside. So I don't expect that a president would nominate someone until March or so, and there would be no chance the person would be confirmed in time to sit in cases even in April, which is the last time they would sit next year. So we're looking now at the first time a new justice would be sitting would be in October of 2017, which is almost 2 years from now. So that's a long period of time. Second, in terms of re-argument, cases that are going to have to be re-argued, and there probably will be some, wouldn't be re-argued until then, and that's a long time for people to wait for justice to occur. Some of these cases were taken by votes in which Justice Scalia was almost certainly one of the voters who wanted the case to be heard, and that dynamic will now change in terms of whether the case would have been taken at all. So I think in all likelihood we will see the court taking fewer cases simply because of the uncertainty. And it may force the court to reach decisions on a 5-3 basis that they wouldn't have reached otherwise. And so it's entirely possible that somehow there'll be a series of compromises across cases and not just within a particular case to be able to see that their job gets done and the American people know what the law is and can continue to operate under it for the next couple of years.
And one quick question before we close, back to you, John Malcolm. Any kind of political damage to either the Democrats or Republicans as a result of this controversy over whether or not Obama should nominate the Supreme Court justice and the rejection by the Republican Senate Majority Leader with respect to hearings?
I have no idea. To those of us who are insiders and who care passionately about this, we believe that the issue of judges and who sits not only in the Supreme Court, but all of the lower courts is an incredibly important issue that ought to be front and center of any presidential race. I think the general public, probably couldn't name any of the justices on the Supreme Court at the moment, has a different view, and whether this will be an issue that will resonate through the election and have an impact on the election or whether it will be yesterday's news by the time November rolls around is something I have no idea about.
Well, a very good point that you brought up, whether or not this will be a topic in the election, to what extent people will take that into consideration, who will be nominating the Supreme Court justice.
They should.
Indeed.
That's, of course, a different question from who should be the nominating the Supreme Court justice from whether the Republicans will be disadvantaged in the election because of the position they took. I saw a poll that said something like 55% of the American public thinks that they should hold hearings. I am not a big fan of polls, and it depends on the way you ask the question. But in terms of the marginal impact on very few voters, I think most voters will feel if they support the Democrats, they should have held hearings and they should have voted. If they support the Republicans, they shouldn't have. And the number of people who are both in the middle and will find this to be the decisive issue is not likely to be very great.
So public opinion on this, it's hard to determine if they agree more with the Republican position, which is now that no hearing should be held. We have to wait to the election.
Well, it'll be a base motivator for both Republicans and Democrats. But I think Alan's precisely right, which is there's that vast movable middle of people who are deciding who they'll want to vote for and whether this particular issue will resonate with them to the point that they're going to decide to vote for the Democrat or the Republican nominee because the Senate Judiciary Committee refused to hold hearings. I would consider it unlikely.
All right, but I think there will be people who properly will take into account the fact that there is definitely a Supreme Court vacancy that we know will be filled, and that will be one of the responsibilities of the President of the United States. And I agree with John, voters ought to take that into account, and I think they will, but they won't in the end. This kerfuffle about whether they should hold hearings or not will fall by the wayside.
All right, a very important point of convergence for both of you. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Malcolm, he's director of the Heritage Foundation's Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Alan Morrison, associate dean for public interest and public service at George Washington University Law School. Thank you both for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.